something that he didn't agree with in his initial assessment, he extended and formalized the refutation and advanced the understanding of black holes, even more. Let me drop. Hawking radiation is one of the biggest discoveries of Stephen Hawking. He wrote extensively about it in both technical papers and his own popular scientific books. The problem with popular science books for non-scientists, though, is that sometimes the authors often will simplify the reasoning involved until it might be very satisfying for the reader. But it reads like a fairy tale to people who know about the subject. And unfortunately, you see this with Stephen Hawking's simplified explanation for Hawking radiation. The way he explained it in many of his popular books was that in the vacuum of space, the virtual particles and antiparticles constantly pop in and out of existence. And when it happens near an event horizon, the antimatter portion is trapped in the horizon. The matter part is expelled away from the black hole, and as the antimatter falls into the black hole, it shrinks its size and mass. Unfortunately, it doesn't. Antiparticles are interesting things, and science has done a lot of experiments with antimatter. And one thing that they seem to have repeatedly shown is that if you collide matter with antimatter, you don't reduce its mass energy. Mass energy is conserved. If antimatter were to fall into the black hole, the black hole's mass would increase, not decrease. And there's no reason to believe that the antiparticle would be the one that fell into the event horizon. You have a 50-50 chance of the matter particle falling in. No, unfortunately, it's way more complicated than that. It may require a full theory of quantum gravity, yet to be, to explain fully. Now, the best attempt that I have seen for non-scientists is a very interesting YouTube. Again, if you point your browser to radiation.ac2gs.com, it's a bit vague because the theory is not complete, but it's a much more rewarding description of what's going on. Beware of simple answers, I always say. Let me drop. Stephen Hawking wasn't always a serious man. In 2009, Stephen Hawking threw a party, but he decided to send the invitations out a week after the party was thrown to invite only time travelers. He said at the time that this was an indication that time travel appeared to be problematic, and it also gave him an excellent excuse to have a bit of champagne. He was famous for offering bets with other renowned scientists, and he was more than happy to pay up when he decided that he had been wrong. In 1974, Stephen Hawking bet Roger Penrose that a cosmic object called Cygnus X-1, a very intense X-ray source, was not a black hole. Hawking would have gotten a subscription to a British humor magazine, Private Eye. If Kip Thorne was proven correct, Hawking would owe him a subscription to Penthouse magazine. Well, in 1990, Hawking sent Thorne his Penthouse subscription, much to Thorne's wife's displeasure. Let me drop. Another famous bet was one Stephen Hawking and the second Thorne had with a guy named John Preskill. It was Hawking's opinion that any information thrown past the event horizon of a black hole was eventually, eternally lost to the universe. Preskill finds that there's a very fundamental concept in quantum physics called information theory that states that information can never be completely destroyed. So he said the information must remain somewhere somehow, even after falling into a black hole. Now, eventually, Hawking came around to Preskill's belief that the information that was trapped inside the event horizon of a black hole is expressed holographically on the surface of the black hole, the black hole's event horizon, which sounds intriguing. I don't know what the hell it means, and hopefully I'll figure it out someday. As agreed, Hawking sent Preskill an Encyclopedia of Baseball, another source of information that he hoped may never be completely destroyed. Unfortunately, Kip Thorne hasn't come around to that idea yet, so he hasn't paid off on that debt. Let me drop. One of Stephen Hawking's latest bets that he recently paid off was the bet he made that the Higgs boson would never be proven. So even the great geniuses can be wrong. He was not a complete optimist either. He believed intelligent alien life was likely, though he thought the probability of contacting them was not that high, and he also thought it was probably for the best, since he did not think that fellowship and the exchange of ideas and of opinions would occur. He felt more like the aliens might just use the Earth to strip it for used parts or leave it a lifeless rock, or even worse, maybe bring civilization in the same way the conquistadors brought civilization to the few remaining Mayans. He also cautioned that artificial intelligence might also be our undoing. Professor Hawkins was not a trusting sort of guy, something that I can identify as a guy from Brooklyn. Stephen Hawkins could be an agent provocateur or just a bit cheeky. In one of his later books, The Grand Design, Hawking lit a few firecrackers at one point. He proclaimed the death of philosophy. He didn't increase his fan base among philosophers. In another part of the same book, you find that he had not disproven the existence of a god, but made God's existence extraneous to the creation of the universe. This did not endear him to many religious people. Let me drop. Speaking at a Google Zeitfest, Zeitgeist conference in Hertfordshire, he echoed his sentiments written about in The Grand Design, that the fundamental questions about the nature of the universe could not be resolved with hard data as that currently being derived from the... could not be resolved without hard data, such as that currently being derived from the Hadron Collider and space research. Quote, "Most of us don't worry about these questions most of the time, but almost all of us must sometimes wonder, why are we here? Where do we come from? Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy, but philosophy is dead. Philosophers have not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly physics." Both. Them's a fighting word. And was Stephen Hawking just being cheeky, argumentative, or trying to elicit a logical counterpoint, or was he just trying to sell books? Who knows? But Stephen Hawking did leave us with another thing to ponder as a going-away present. His last known paper is entitled A Smooth Exit, Eternal Inflation, which is available, again, if you want to use your web browser, you just type hawking.ac2gs.com, and his final paper will show up in front of you. It involves something called anti-de-Sitter conformal field theory correspondence. So it isn't for the faint of heart, but it is thought-provoking. Reduced to its basic premise, it suggests a multiverse, which is eternally experiencing the inflation believed to occur at the very earliest fraction of a second in the life of our universe, the very first 10 to the minus 30 seconds of the first second. In Hawking's theory, the universe such as our own dropped out of inflationary phase, creating so-called pocket universes, and each and every pocket universe may possess its own
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Each pocket universe might randomly be set with a number of arbitrary values for its universal constants, and in those pocket universes, where the numbers add up to a stable universe with stars and planets and sentient life, their occupants are wondering how it all worked out so right, so arbitrarily. The idea is that in many of the other pocket universes where the numbers weren't conducive to matter, stars, planets, and life, there's no opportunity to reflect upon what the hell went wrong. What are these universal constants? They are a set of dimensionless constants that are not derivable using any known theory nor any known equation. We know what they are because we've measured them. In our present standard model, we know of 25 such fundamental dimensionless constants. There's the fine structure constant, which is basically the relative strength of the electromagnetic force in relation to the strong force. There's a strong coupling constant, which is the relative strength of the nuclear strong force. There are the 15 relative masses of 6 quarks, 6 leptons, a Higgs boson, a W boson, and a Z boson relative to Planck's mass. There's 4 parameters for how quarks oscillate and 4 more parameters for neutrinos. There's probably going to be more. Stephen Hawking's latest contribution for a possible model for the multiverse takes its place alongside an almost infinitely growing collection of suggested models. Let me drop. There is one that sounds like the complete opposite of Hawking's mind. There are pocket universes pinch off from our universe into their own little teeny pocket universes, along with their own random set of universal constants. But these models aren't nearly as strange as other models, where universes go from bang to crunch to bang to crunch to bang to crunch. That's the usual oscillation. Roger Penrose has one where he stacks those shuttlecocks up one on top of the other, and he has no need for the crush. He goes from boom to boom to boom without it ever going down in size. It's Roger Penrose's conformal cyclic cosmology, and it doesn't even invoke the concept of inflation. Roger Penrose thinks inflation isn't required, even temporarily, yet Stephen Hawking believes that inflation is eternal. One more firecracker lobbed into the field on his way. He will be missed. The end.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
One thing he always wanted to do was go into space. The closest thing he could do to make an arrangement for that, he did about 10 years ago, and got himself to Florida, and he went on the C-135, the Vomit Comet, and he went on his parabolic arc, so he got, you know, each time you do that, you get like 30 seconds of weightlessness, and he did quite good. They wrapped him up, and you know, he felt it was a great equalizer. You know, he couldn't move around, but, you know, he was doing what everybody else was doing. And the report came back that he was thrilled that he was able to do it. Back to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. And I've seen pictures of him, and I don't know if I'm inferring it or whether he still had enough muscle control, but it looked like he had a big smile on his face, and he was having loads of fun.
Yes, that's right. And that was only, I think just over 10 years ago he made those arrangements. So, you never know. The great equalizer. Shoot these guys into space, and they'll all be happy.
Well, it depends on the people. I mean, my understanding is that an interesting percentage of astronauts don't really take to low gravity at first, and you can't predict who will do it. You know, and sometimes they'll do well the first time in the ISS, and the second or third, they'll start to upchuck. So one of many physiological problems that medical science is going to have to deal with one of these days.
Yeah, I read a tap, and in fact, I just saw an interview with one of the astronauts that just, he was talking about the flight that was just going up, but he gave his comment. He says, sick as a dog for 3 days, but he says the body is a wonderful instrument. After 3 days, he says he adjusted perfectly, and he had no problem for the next couple of months he was up there.
My concerns are for all the other factors that come into play at either zero or very low gravity. A lot of astronauts have had to take to wearing glasses who never needed them before because of problems with their optic nerve and increased cerebral fluid pressure and osteoporosis and all manner of things. It's not healthy. We're not really designed for that environment. So someone's going to have to do a lot of thinking about ways of tricking our physiology into thinking it has a gravitational force on it.
Yeah, I think the only way to do it is to set up a big wheel up there somehow. And you know, I mean, the cost would be phenomenal, but you need to have something spinning for these people to go on long distance flights. You know, until they, you know, 100 years from now, when they can change the genetics and change human beings to be able to adapt. But getting back to Hawkins, that final paper of his, I did see that one clip, and I like the idea that he says that all these other multi-universes left an imprint.
imprint, possibly left an imprint on the outside of our universe. And it might be able to pick it up with a, you know, shoot a spacecraft up there, some kind of instrumentation to be able to detect that, you know, that imprint that it left, you know, as a scar on the outside of the, our own universe, looking at the microwave background radiation. And that's what I got out of reading out a little bit about his last piece of, you know, that last paper that he was going to publish if he stayed alive. They still think they're going to publish it. AC2GSWS2S. AC2GS. Yeah, I think they're going to publish it. I don't really see any reason why they're not going to, but the popular press mentioned that, and I kept reading through the actual article, and I couldn't really pin down what method he was suggesting to do that with. I don't know if you read the actual article. I don't know if he was talking about the cosmic background radiation, microwave radiation, or I'm pinning a lot of my hopes on gravitational waves that eventually when someone's able to build something big enough to pick out what would be the background gravitational wave background of the Big Bang, that should add a lot more information, but that's all conjecture on my part.
Yeah, maybe that's what he was getting at, but you know, I couldn't tell. He just said the background radiation, or I don't know if he said that, but you know, the transcribing of what he said, maybe. Don't forget, you know, it's somebody else writing it about that paper. All right, if you have the actual paper, I'll probably read that. I'll go to Hawkins AC2GS.com and take a look. But he said it's pretty deep. We'll see. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's very deep. There are a lot of equations. There are a lot of rather complicated topology discussions that could be very confusing, and I tried to follow it as best I could, but again, I couldn't really find the... He didn't set up an experiment to do. He might have inferred that there might be an experiment at some point, but he was much more theoretical, at least from the way that I was put it together. So once again, for anyone who kind of listened to that and might be vaguely interested in any of those pages, there's three pages that I cited that you just go to your web browser and you type in these words and you'll get them. If you want to get a copy of Hawking's last paper, it's hawking.ac2gs.com. And keep in mind, his name does not end with an S. It ends with a G. It's Hawking, not Hawking. So hawking.ac2gs.com. If you want to see a wonderful YouTube about Hawking radiation, it's radiation.ac2gs.com. And if you want to see a whole series of very interesting videos on the Big Bang theories that very brilliant physicists have, it's bang.ac2gs.com. So keep those three things in mind, and when you have nothing better to do, YouTube is a fun thing to play with sometimes. Any further questions, comments, statements, anything that interests anyone about black holes and the Big Bang?
Yes, I've got some questions, Roy. In the case of the so-called event horizon, when something falls into a black hole and goes beyond the event horizon, it's inside of that surface where the escape velocity is greater than the speed of light, therefore that object can never come back out again. That's the event horizon. I think there's also something called the Schwarzschild radius. Is that identical? And if it's not, what's the difference? Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yes, they are completely identical. They are the same exact thing. Now, some people think that the event horizon or the Schwarzschild radius is solely determined by the mass. It's mostly related to the mass, but just as we talk about planets that revolve and bulge a little bit at their mid portion, if a black hole has a spin, the Schwarzschild radius kind of bulges at that radius also. So there's a little distortion caused by spin. And the characteristics of a black hole, as I think I mentioned before, is charge, angular velocity, spin, and mass. Using those three, you could pretty much find any black hole in the universe.
I'm going to guess there's one more factor describing a black hole: temperature. The material that fell into the black hole, sometimes that material fell in at high velocity to begin with, and some of it low, and some of it missed the center. So you have different amounts of spin, different amounts of charge, different amounts of temperature. I can see the possibility of a black hole having a lot higher temperature than another one because of the method by which it formed and what was the raw ingredients from which it formed. And since temperature really is the kinetic energy of the molecules, we're really talking about how fast is the stuff moving inside of the black hole if it has a high temperature. Has Hawking said anything along these lines, Roy, AC2GS, K2IW?
Let me rephrase very slightly on a semantic. Not necessarily the mass of the black hole, but the mass energy of the black hole. And so the momentum of the particles and the average kinetic energy of the particles all goes into the same situation. It's mass energy. They're equivalent. You know, you can't have mass without the energy content. Have energy without the mass content. So I would redefine what I just said and say that the characteristic is mass energy content. How's that?
That sounds good. But now, when it comes to what many people believe, and maybe Hawking's was one of them, they believe the material inside of a black hole is a singularity. In other words, the material gets squeezed down to a diameter of essentially zero. And I'm having a lot of trouble with that for two reasons. One, if the black hole has a temperature, and that temperature in some cases might be 10 to the 33 degrees Kelvin, that really means that the material inside is moving at the 0.999 the speed of light in its velocity in order to represent that temperature. And how can something be moving at such a high velocity and yet have no dimension of diameter? On top of that, I'm sure every black hole has a rotational kinetic energy. Rotational kinetic energy is a function of how much mass and how much moment of inertia. Moment of inertia is a function of diameter squared. So if the singularity has zero dimension, that's a fancy way of saying it has zero moment of inertia. If it has zero moments of inertia, it cannot preserve rotational kinetic energy. So one of the very well held theories of science is that energy and matter cannot be created or destroyed, just changed to another form. If you're going to preserve temperature, you need a dimension. If you're going to preserve rotational kinetic energy, you need a dimension. Therefore, it is my guess that the material inside of a black hole has some kind of a distribution. It might be linear, it might be Gaussian, it might be Rayleigh, but it's got a distribution. It can't be a singularity, I believe.
Repeater, time out.
I'm reasonably sure that the published reports are going to be against what I just said. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Well, the beauty of it all is once it passes the event horizon, your guess is as good as mine or even Hawking's, although he could draw prettier equations than both of us. The problem is, and I too sort of agree, I don't like singularities with infinite densities and all kinds of infinities and things that don't quite make sense in my head. But the problem is that in order to really explain whether or not there is a singularity requires a really good solution to quantum gravity, because relativities work at those infinitely small places. So you have to come up with a whole new theory. Now, he worked around the edges and he wrote that wave equation for the universe, but that's a little baby step. There's a lot more steps that are necessary, and until then, no one's going to have a clue, but then no one's going to be able to prove anything because you can't get past the event horizon. So you may be right, but that's not what Hawking's. Hawking kind of really assumed that there was a fundamental singularity at the core. Now, obviously, if things are falling into the event horizon, they don't instantaneously go to the center. So there's a steady state type of situation mostly going on. But Hawking's really, really was obsessed with singularities as the underlying reason for a black hole being.
Is it true that there are some black holes that seem to be spinning very rapidly, and the material that tries to fall into them, a certain percentage of that material becomes squirted out from the North Pole and the South Pole at very high velocity? I think there are some black holes that display that kind of a characteristic. Obviously, neutron stars do, and that's where our pulsars come from, but I think black holes can also do that. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Well, again, it becomes a matter of semantics. None of these particles that are ejected out of the poles are ejected out of the event horizon. They're coming out of the accretion disk that's beyond the radius of the event horizon, because, unfortunately, there's no theory that would explain anything popping out of the event horizon. Light itself is the fastest thing there is, and the escape velocity for black holes is greater than that. So there's no way of getting around it. The closest way of getting around it was the fudge factor of the Hawking's radiation, which, again, is very poorly understood by just about everyone because it's ridiculously complicated and, once again, really is going to need a theory of quantum gravity. So that's the accretion disk that's having the ejection, not really the black hole itself.
But if that accretion disk is on the outside of a black hole that is spinning very rapidly, could that be one of the causative agents of these particles being squirted out of the North and South Pole? Over to you, Roy.
Very possibly. I don't think you have any similar phenomena on a theoretical basis, because there isn't a lot of black hole practical information, but on a theoretical basis, most of these ejections from the accretion disk tend to be from black holes that possess a certain degree of angular momentum. It is theoretically possible, although I think rather dubious, to have a black hole that has a net zero angular velocity. I think the odds of that are ridiculously high. If you didn't have that, then you wouldn't have a lot of those forces that cause ejection from accretion disk. So I think that's part of the mechanism going on. But it's outside the event horizon, not inside.
There are some very dense neutron stars that have an extremely strong magnetic field. I think they're sometimes called magnetars. Is there a black hole equivalent of a magnetar? And of all the properties we've discussed of a black hole, is the amount of magnetism one of the variables? W. Roy, KGIW.
Unfortunately, unless I misinterpret everything, no, they can't, because once again, magnetism is carried by electromagnetism, electromagnetic waves, which are photons, which are trapped in the event horizon. So there might be external magnetic fields created by an accretion disk, but as far as from the event horizon inside, all those virtual photons that we tend to see as magnetic forces are trapped.
Okay, so you believe that you've read that Hawking has said that no external magnetic field because it has an event horizon that can't be exceeded. The fact that gravity of the black hole does exceed, come through the event horizon, that suggests that gravity is not an electromagnetic wave, even though it also just happens to propagate at the speed of light. Ain't that coincidental? Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Okay, but similarity isn't proof of equality. As I think I've mentioned a couple of times, it's not an inherent aspect of light that the speed of the velocity of the speed of light through vacuum. It's an inherent characteristic of space-time itself, and all of these things are embedded in space-time. A black hole can't pinch off space-time per se. It warps it, and that's the gravitational forces that one feels. But it's not a particle per se that's just sitting around that can be trapped by a gravitational field. Force carriers have to be unaffected by the forces that they carry. Photons. You could put an electrical charge anywhere you want in the path of a photon. It's going to keep going. Force carriers don't interact with their forces. Otherwise, there's a feedback loop and the universe breaks down.
Earlier you mentioned multiverse, and I think there's a very large number of ways you can create a multiverse. And I didn't hear you mention the one that I think is very possible. And that is, you start off knowing that mankind in the very beginning was very arrogant, whether for religious reasons, and we thought the earth was created in 7 days, or some other reason. We believe the earth was the center of everything, and all those stars and planets revolved around us. Well, that was our original arrogance. We became humble to find out that the earth goes around the sun. We wanted to think the sun was the center. Well, the sun is part of a galaxy. We wanted to believe our galaxy is the center. Well, our galaxy is part of a galactic group. We wanted to believe the galactic group is everything. Well, the galactic group is part of something called the observable universe. So 6 or 7 times in a row, we've been humbled. Therefore, it is my belief that once we make enough measurements, we will eventually confirm that there are multiverses. By that I mean there wasn't just one Big Bang at one period. There wasn't a Big Bang or multiple Big Bangs at one period of time at one place. Let me drop. I'm of the strong belief that beyond our observable universe, beyond where we can see and measure, way outside there, at other periods of time, there were other Big Bangs. To think that there was only one Big Bang and we just happened to be in the middle of the only one is again too arrogant. I'm convinced that out there, there are multiple Big Bangs at very great distances. Of course, to confirm this right now is going to be very difficult, but we've seen a hint of that. We see hints of gravity, mass concentrations out at the perimeter. And the attraction of the material toward those concentrations may be an explanation for the acceleration that we've been measuring for the last 15 or 20 years. That what we call acceleration, and we call it dark energy that's pushing material out, really is a material out there being sucked into other local gravity concentrations of other Big Bangs that we can't see because they're too far away. But the material out there in our perimeter is sensing that local gravity. So, once again, I think there can be multiple Big Bangs at very great distances at other periods of time. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
AC2GS, and it's as good a theory as any. It comes close to something called drift theory, in which the theory is that the universe is not as homogeneous as isotropic as we think it is, that there are beyond the observable universe that are causing, you know, some summation gravitational forces every which way pulling us apart. So it is part of a bigger theory, although it's not a terribly popular theory. Most theories are incredibly non-classical, in which the universal constants are able to be randomly changed, and all the universes are kind of closed off from each other. In your vision, if you just had a spaceship that could go fast enough, you could reach any other point in that multiverse, right?
No. The distance is so great, the rate of expansion is so great, even at near the speed of light with velocity, if I could achieve it, I'm not going to get out there to be able to see those other universes. We're seeing evidence of it. There's two or three pieces of very subtle evidence. One, the so-called expansion that we see. A possible explanation for the expansion is really the material out there at the perimeter. By the way, the expansion is only from the material that's far away. The material in close to us is decelerating because of local central gravity, so to speak. So it's only the far material that's accelerating, and we think it's being repulsed. I think it's being attracted to something else. But when you look at the cosmic microwave background of WMAP and COBE and Planck, these very fancy radiometer satellites that have made the measurement of the cosmic background radiation, it is moderately uniform, but it is not perfectly uniform. If the universe really went to infinity in every direction, it'd have an infinite number of stars in every direction. Let me drop. And so every direction you look, you would eventually be seeing a star, and this is part of Alba's paradox, why isn't the sky white? Well, it really is white, depending on your definition of white. If I use enough optical magnification, there is light in every direction. The cosmic background pictures show that to us. But there are concentrations, there are local hotspots throughout that whole observable sphere. And so that is a subtle piece of evidence of other multiverses, I believe. I'll admit that's not an easy one to sell. But to travel out there to confirm it, I think the distances are too great, and by the time, the rate of expansion of the material, if I go far enough from us, you approach the place where, with relation to us, the expansion rate is essentially the speed of light. I can never get out to the leading edge after the Big Bang itself. At the very Big Bang, some material was moving very fast, and that material had a great head start. I don't think I can ever catch up with it. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Okay, and I agree with you that the limitations as we understand the laws of physics make traveling there impossible simply because there's not enough time and enough speed to get any place near there. But that's at least more classical than most of the theories proposed, where the actual space-time is pinched off, and even if you had an infinitely fast, if you had a tachyon drive, and you had an infinitely fast engine, you still couldn't reach these pocket universes because they were pinched off and they weren't connected anymore. So that tends to be most of the theories that are out there right now, these very moments. Whereas we don't know how big the universe really is. We only know how big the observable universe is in the time frame that we can visualize it. And we can infer how far the boundaries that we could see that are 13.8 billion light years away and therefore 13.8 billion years in the past and project where they might be today. But for know this could be 0.00000 1% of our own universe that we can observe. You know, the light cone can only go so far in the last 13.8 billion years.
We call our observable universe 13.7 or 13.8 billion light years in radius. But there's other ways of explaining it where the material out at the perimeter of our observable universe and some of the material beyond that point has been moving away from us, and it really is, some of that material is, although we can't observe it, is 40 billion light years away. So maybe the real universe of our Big Bang is a number like 80 billion light years. But of those other multiverses, maybe the nearest one is 100 billion light years away. It's had its big bang, and its material is expanding out, similar to ours, depending on when it started, and there's a large number of them in every single possible direction you can go. It's a pretty lofty theory. Proving it is essentially impossible. And by the way, you and I, if we had a motor that could bring us up to the speed of light, we wouldn't want to use it, Roy. All you'd have to do is encounter a molecule, one molecule of hydrogen that I'd run into when I'm moving at the speed of light is going to destroy my spaceship, and there's always stuff out there you're going to run into. So if you can move at the speed of light, unless you've got the world's best force field you can put in front of you, a shield, I don't think you want to use it. Okay, Roy, K2RW.
Well, I mean, once again, I agree with you. I mean, in the real world, everything falls apart. You know, most wonderful theories kind of don't quite work the way you want them to. But I was jumping to the next level of absurdity. Forget about light speed. If there were tachyons, which I don't think they are, tachyons are a solution to Dirac's equation, where the mass is an imaginary number. So the square of the mass is negative. So if such a weird thing were to exist, at rest, a tachyon would travel at infinitely fast speed. So it would get anywhere instantly. So I was taking it to that absurd example. But yes, you would need some heck of a lot of shielding.
In Star Trek, the original series, when Scotty used the engines right at the limit, and he got the ship up to warp 8. Roughly what speed was warp 8?
Well, now that's a real tough one, because they really changed the definition. At one point or another, it was proposed that warp drives were exponentials of the speed of light. So it would be 10 to the 8th C. But they fudged that later on, and they changed it as the plot device was required. The concept was that you weren't traveling through space. The approach that they took, which had some good theoretical bounding, if not reality-based bounding, was that the limitations are only when you try to move in space-time. If you can figure a way of going around space-time through what, I don't know, but that's the concept that they used of warp space or wormholes or all kinds of things, is a method of getting around the idea of having to go through the substance that we call space-time.
AC2LR with a comment.
I've got another question, but go ahead, Kate.
I was just this week reading the book called The Grand Design by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Lodinow, I think his last name is pronounced. And I underlined a specific line about the expansion of the universe during the Big Bang. And Hawking says, "It was as if a coin, 1 centimeter in diameter, suddenly blew up to 10 million times the width of the Milky Way. This may seem to violate relativity, which dictates that nothing can move faster than light. But that speed limit does not apply to the expansion of space itself." And then he goes on to explain how the expansion of space is outside the limitations of speed of light. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, this expansion of space itself at beyond the speed of light, to me, sounds like a hokey attempt at a solution, very similar to back in the geocentric universe, because of the way the planets move, we had to evoke epicycles, which again were very hokey, and nobody explained where all of the acceleration energy was coming from to create these epicycles. So creating this expansion of the universe right after the Big Bang, I don't like it because it's so hokey, and I think there's a better explanation. Let me show you what it is. And I'm really asking Roy how crazy this one is. When you know the amount of mass of a black hole, there's a formula you can go to. It'll tell you what is the diameter. Okay? Our observable universe has approximately 100 billion stars per galaxy. That's 10 to the 11 stars per galaxy. And there's approximately 10 to the 11 observable galaxies. So therefore, there's 10 to the 22 observable stars. Maybe it's 10 to the 23. If I take the mass of 10 to the 23 solar masses, put it all together in one clump, which is what happened before the Big Bang, and I calculate what is the event horizon, that event horizon is way beyond the diameter of our solar system, and I'm not quite sure what percentage of the diameter of our galaxy it is. So if the event horizon of the pre-Big Bang material was really that big, and if the material had the distributions I've been talking about, it's not a singularity. It has a distribution that's uniform, Gaussian, Rayleigh, whatever. If it already is distributed inside of that event horizon, and then you create a Big Bang explosion, the material already is greatly spread out, and you almost don't need this universe expansion, this period of expansion anymore. Has anybody ever said anything close to that, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW?
Not to my knowledge. They've pretty much all settled on the fact of an original crunch, which inflation has a lot of problems with in my head as well. I mean, the theory is that most of the inflation occurred, like I said before, something like the first 10 to the 34th of a second. Real small amount of time. There's nothing that anyone, science cannot measure that fraction of a second. And yet that was the fraction of a second that it went from supposedly a singularity to a good portion of what the universe is. And I don't know. I don't really have that much problem with the concept that space-time is something, as opposed to nothing is really nothing. Space-time are full of fields, of quantum field theory. Says it's full of fields. So it's something, and traveling through it slows you down to the speed of light. So I can sort of believe that you could grow a thing faster than you can travel through that thing. And that's all that they say. Where I have a big problem is it totally violates the conservation of mass energy rule, in that people with a straight face tell me that the net energy mass energy of this universe is zero.
These discussions of 10 to the minus 33 periods of time, to me, are absolutely crazy. I, for one, have worked with equipment that generates electronic pulses, video or RF, at a quarter of a nanosecond, 250 picoseconds. A nanosecond is 10 to the minus 9 seconds. The speed of light is 1 nanosecond per foot. So in 1 nanosecond, at the speed of light, something travels very close to 1 foot. 1,000 times smaller than that is a picosecond. That's now 1/100th of an inch. 10,000th of an inch is a picosecond, 10 to the minus 12. By the time you get to 10 to the minus 15, 10 to the minus 18, you're down to the size of protons and protons and electrons almost, at the speed of light. To talk about periods of time that represent a distance at the speed of light that's smaller than the particles that we talk about, to me is crazy. Yeah, if you've got a singularity, and if you've got the really serious, what's the word for it now, faith, that everything goes to absolutely zero distance in the dimension, then maybe you come up with these 10 to the minus 33 times. But when it comes to realistic size of the subatomic components, protons, neutrons, even quarks, maybe even the strings. The dimensions of these objects doesn't come anywhere near 10 to the minus 33 in time. So that number, to me, is crazy. Okay, Roy, KQIW.
I'm not sure. I think there are Planck times and Planck measurements lengths that are infinitesimally much smaller than quarks or anything. They're just very small numbers that haven't been able to be achieved anywhere near. The problem, as I get the sense from physicists, is that as much as I agree with you, there is a slight in uniformity of the cosmic background, but it's infinitesimally non-uniform. And in order for vast regions of space covering billions of light years to all have almost the same uniform intensity, you got to start from the beginning, and then you got to figure out how the hell did it get so far. So you kind of stuck with big, ridiculous-sounding numbers, or small ones, depending upon your perspective.
VDH with a question.
Let's get Kay finish first. I didn't let Kay finish her statement that she was saying. Go ahead, Kay.
I'm definitely done. I would love to hear what VDH has to say.
You've got it, VDH.
Okay, fine. This is Jesse. Good evening to Kate. Good evening to everybody on the net. I've heard of a unit of time called a chronon. It's supposed to be approximately the time it takes light to cross a hydrogen atom. And it's supposedly represented a quantization of time itself, where that for time intervals shorter than this time, it was impossible to distinguish past from present. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
You got it, Roy.
I'm not sure if that's fundamentally the smallest number that you could ever come to. I mean, I really don't know that much about it, unfortunately, but it strikes me as hydrogen atoms are way too big, and you got quarks that are a point particles. You got electrons that are point particles. They have no dimension. So you're probably able to measure time intervals somehow at smaller sizes, I would think. And again, I would also think that this would be in the back of people's mind when they keep on writing about the inflationary theories and throwing these very fractional seconds out there. I would hope that there's nothing inherently, theoretically impossible about them.
Mr. VDH, is your name Robert or John? There's two different VDHs that would have those two names. Over to you, Mr. VDH.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's John, and the complete call is WA2VDH. Yeah, the handle is John.
And you're the John in Roosevelt, New York. Okay, so like Roy is sort of saying, if the amount of time required to travel at the speed of light is less than the amount of time that it takes to traverse the smallest particles you can envision, and to talk about more brief periods of time than that, I don't think has useful application. How do you use a unit of time that is way smaller than anything that you can devise? Over to you, Roy. Get your IW.
Well, I mean, one of the big problems with quantum mechanics is that ultimately, if you go down the rabbit hole far enough, they speak of quantum foam, where everything stops being what we would think of as analog, and everything becomes kind of like digital or quantized. in that, you know, it's that old Zeno's paradox of cutting a line in half and that in a half and that in a half. In an analog world, you could keep doing that for the forever, because there's no ultimate length that's the shortest it could be. But according to quantum mechanics, there's such things as Planck length. So there's all kinds of Planck numbers. So there's also Planck time. I think Planck time is something like 5 × 10⁻⁴ seconds. And that's even smaller than the fraction that we're talking about inflation.
So is there a Planck time and a Planck distance which represents the smallest that's ever possible? Which reminds me a little bit of that joke you've heard before. A mathematician and an engineer are talking about halving the distance. If I keep halving the distance between me and Marilyn Monroe, the mathematician says you never get there. The engineer says in a short period of time, I get close enough for all practical purposes. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, that points out the practicality of engineers and the theoretical constructs of theoreticians. I'd like to have both of them. I wrote an article about how amateurs have to be one part technician, one part engineer, and one part scientist. And that you need all three of those aspects of a person. So I still feel that way. These are theoretical constructs, the Planck time, the Planck length and such. They may be disproven, but they're the ones that are published that theoreticians are puttering around with. So although the lengths of things that you can measure are much, much bigger and much, much longer than them, the understanding is that as you peel away the onion layers, you'll get finer and finer detail and approach these type of Planck quantities.
Net time complete.
They're just trying to tell us it's 11 o'clock and they're going to change the way they do the beeping, I think. Of the people listening to us, you guys must have some further questions you might want to ask any of the people above. Give us your call letters right now. It sounds like...
blinded them with science.
It sounds like your explanation is so complete, Roy, that they're left with no further questions on this subject. Well done. Over to you, Roy.
AC2LR, question.
Uh-huh. Go right ahead, Kate.
Oh, I retract that. statement. in the book, The Grand Design, by Stephen Hawking and Leonard Lonadel, the theories and the ideas in the book agree with what both of you are saying. It's a little book, too. You can find it at the library, The Grand Design, if you want to read more on how time can't be, you have to be brought down to a certain minute amount, and that it's also impossible to bring it down to a minute amount. It's a little over my head. It's talking about Feynman theories and all these other, you know, like more advanced physics, but if you like that, you'll really enjoy this book. This is Kay, AC2LR, back to you, Dick.
Okay, give us some of the things that you remember reading in that book. Even just give it to us as headlines, so to speak. So what are some of the subjects that were in that book, and what do you believe they were saying? And tell us once again the name of the book.
The name of the book is The Grand Design, and I'll read to you from page 78, two sentences. Feynman's theory gives an especially clear picture of how a Newtonian world picture can arise from quantum physics, which seems very different. According to Feynman's theory, the phases associated with each path, this is a path between two points, with each path depend on Planck's constant. The theory dictates that because Planck's constant is so small, when you add the contribution from paths that are close to each other, the phases normally vary wildly. And so, as in the figure above, which you can't see the figure, they tend to add to zero. It goes on, but it's, you know, so he's kind of showing how you compare and contrast all the theories and where they overlap.
That was Richard Feynman, a wonderful Far Rockaway guy, and that was his many paths interpretation.
Now, we sort of discussed a Planck distance and a Planck time tonight. And the Planck constant is a number. And what does that number represent?